Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 12, Discourse Number 10.
The first question. Bhagwan, you continually speak of dropping the ego. But how can I do so when I can't distinguish between what is the ego and what is my true nature? Ananda Vedanta The ego cannot be dropped. It is just like darkness. You cannot drop darkness. You can only bring light in. The moment the light is, the darkness is no more. You can say this is the way of dropping the darkness. But don't take it literally. Darkness does not exist at all. It is absence of light. Hence you cannot do anything directly to it. You can do only something to the light, either bring light in or take light out. If you want darkness, put the light off. If you don't want darkness, put the light on. The ego cannot be dropped. Meditation can be learned. Meditation functions as a light. Meditation is light. Become light. And you will not find the ego anywhere. If you want to drop it, you will be in trouble. Because who is this one who wants to drop it? It is the ego itself now playing a new game, the game called spirituality, religion, self-realization. Who is asking this question? It is the ego itself befooling you. And when the ego asks how the ego can be dropped, naturally you think, this can't be the ego. How ego can ask for its own suicide? That's how ego goes on deceiving you. Your self nature has no questions. It needs no answers. Your self nature is absolutely light. Full of light. It knows no darkness. It has never met any darkness. Bodhidharma reached China. One of the greatest Buddhas of all the ages. After Gautam Buddha, Bodhidharma seems to be the most precious person in the Buddhist heritage. When he reached China, his fame reached far ahead of him. Even the Emperor Wu, who ruled over the whole of China, came to receive him on the boundary. And the conversation that transpired between the two is of immense importance. It has to be meditated upon again and again. It has tremendous message for you all. The Emperor Wu was not only a great emperor, he was very religious too. And he has done much for Gautam Buddha's message. In fact, no other person except the Emperor Asoka has done so much for Buddhism as Emperor Wu had done. He transformed the whole China into a Buddhist world. He made thousands of temples for Buddha. He made hundreds of monasteries. Millions of Buddhist monks were supported by the royal treasury. He translated all the Buddhist scriptures into Chinese. Thousands of his scholars worked for years, almost their whole lives. He had done great work. Naturally, he wanted to know from Bodhidharma, what is my merit? The first thing that he asked Bodhidharma was, I have done so much. What is my merit? What I have gained? What virtue? Bodhidharma looked at him very sternly. If you have seen Bodhidharma's pictures, you will be puzzled. He looks more like a lion than like a man. Very fierce. His eyes are very penetrating, like swords. He must have cut Wu to his proper size just by his look. Wu started trembling. He had never come against such a man. He has conquered many enemies. He has conquered many dangerous kings. But Bodhidharma was the most dangerous person he had come across. It was a cool morning, but he started perspiring. And Bodhidharma said, merit, virtue, you stupid. This is the ego and nothing else. Now getting nourished and fat in the name of religion and spirituality. You are bound for seventh hell, mind you. Wu could not believe his ears, could not believe his eyes. He said, but thousands of other monks have come from India and they have all said, Vuvu, you have done a great service to Buddha's religion. You are a beloved of Buddha. You are blessed by Buddha. But what you are saying is just the opposite. Bodhidharma said, forget all about those monks. They were buttressing you. They were praising you. Because they know that that's what you expected from them. They are cunning and crafty people. They know nothing of Buddha and his message. I am a Buddha myself. I am not a Buddhist monk. I speak on my own authority. And I say to you, you are cursed. Emperor Wu asked, do you mean to say there is nothing holy, nothing spiritual in all these beautiful acts? Bodhidharma said, no action is holy. Because every action arises out of the ego. When you forget all about actions, when you disappear and things start happening on their own and you cannot claim that they are your actions, only then something of immense value, of immense beauty penetrates your life. Spirituality has nothing to do with doing. Spirituality is the fragrance of being. And you are not a being yet. You are still concerned that you have done this, you have done that. The ego is a doer. Your self-nature is a non-doer. Your self-nature simply allows existence to flow through it. It simply allows the ultimate law to function through it. Your self-nature is just a hollow bamboo in the hands of the ultimate nature. It becomes a flute. And a beautiful song is born out of it. But the flute cannot say, this is my song. What is my merit? What I am going to gain out of it? Into what heaven? To what joys I will attain? The bamboo flute is just nothing. Its whole being consists of nothingness. That's why the song can flow through it. It is utterly empty. Shocked. But who could see the point? He said, you are the first man who are not impressed by my great power, money, my empire. You are the first man with whom I am feeling that something is possible. How can I drop this ego? Yes, I can understand your point. First I was claiming a great empire. Now I am claiming something of the beyond. But the claim is the same, and the claimer is the same. I can see your point. I bow down my head to you. I am grateful that you have not been polite to me, that you have hit me hard, you have wounded me, but I am thankful. How can I drop this ego? And Bodhidharma asks, what ego you want to drop? Again you want to do something. If you drop, then the ego will persist. This is the subtle game of ego. If you drop, the ego starts coming from the back door. It starts saying, look, I have dropped the ego. Look how humble I am. There is nobody who is more humble than me. I am the humblest person in the world. Just dust unto your feet. But look into the eyes. Look into the heart of the man who is claiming that he is the humblest person. It is the same ego. It is not egolessness. Egolessness cannot claim humbleness. Egolessness cannot claim egolessness. Egolessness cannot claim at all. It simply falls silent. It cannot even say, I am not. I am nobody. Because the I can exist in any claim whatsoever. The emperor asks, then you help me, because I cannot get out of this ego. Bodhidharma said, you come early in the morning, 3 o'clock. Come alone. Don't bring anybody with you. And don't be worried. I will finish it once for all. The emperor could not sleep the whole night. What does he mean, this mad monk? He will finish it once for all? And the man looks so dangerous, and 3 o'clock is not the time to meet such a person. He can do anything. He is so unpredictable. And he has asked that I should come alone. Many times he decided not to go. But the pull was great. The man had something magnetic. He had to go. At 3 o'clock he found himself getting ready. He went. Bodhidharma was staying outside the town in a small temple. It was dark and Bodhidharma was waiting with his staff in his hand. And he said, so you have come, although you hesitated much. You decided many times not to come. You could not sleep the whole night. Neither did you allow me to sleep, because I had to go on pulling you. But now that you have come, things can be settled forever. Sit in front of me. Close your eyes. Go in and find out where the ego is. And don't fall asleep because I am sitting in front of you with my staff. I will hit you on the head immediately if you go to sleep. Be alert, because when I really hit hard. And find out. If you can find out the ego, just show me that this is the ego and I will finish it. First you have to find it out where it is. The emperor followed the logic. He closed his eyes. It was impossible to fall asleep. He was sitting there. He could see him even with closed eyes that he is sitting there. And once in a while he will hit his staff on the ground just to make him sure that I am here. You go on searching. 2 hours passed, 3 hours passed. Wu looked and looked. For the first time he looked inside. In fact, if you look inside and you can remain alert just for 48 minutes, that is the limit. The ego can go on eluding you only for 48 minutes, not more than that. This has been the experience of all the Buddhas down the ages. Now don't ask why 48 minutes, because that's impossible to answer. It is just like at 100 degrees the water evaporates. Nobody asks why. Why not at 99 degrees? Why not at 101 degree? There is no saying about it. It simply is so. The law of nature. At 100 degrees, the water evaporates. Exactly like that. If you can remain alert and watchful, continuously, without wavering, for 48 minutes, your whole inner being becomes so quiet, so silent, so peaceful, so alert. For the first time there is clarity, transparent clarity. You can see everything that is there. And Wu looked and looked and looked and could not find any ego. Because ego cannot be found. It is fictitious. It is just your idea. It has no substance in it. It is not even a shadow. What to say about substance? It exists only because you have not looked in. Looking in, your light is discovered, which is always there. Just you have to look in and find it. He was looking for the ego, but he found the light. Because the ego is not there and the light is there. He had gone to search for the ego, but he found the light. And once the light was there, there was no darkness. 3 hours passed and then the sun was rising. And Wu's face was transformed. He had a new beauty, a new grace. Bodhidharma laughed and he said, "Now open your eyes. You have not been able to find it. So So I have finished it forever. Wu opened his eyes, touched Bodhidharma's feet, and said, "Master, you have not done anything, and yet you have finished it. That's the miracle of a master. He never does a thing, and yet the ultimate miracle happens in his presence. His presence is the miracle. His presence has the magical quality." Ananda Vedanta, you need not drop the ego. You just look in. Search where it is. First find it out. And don't be worried about self nature right now. You just go in the search for the ego. And you will not find the ego. Instead, you will find your self nature, luminous, fragrant, like a lotus flower. One never comes across such beauty anywhere else. It is the most beautiful experience of life. And once you have seen your own lotus of light, your own lotus blossoming, the ego is finished forever. Then you will not ask such meaningless questions. How to distinguish, you say, between what is the ego and what is my true nature? Either the ego is there, then the true nature is not known. Or the true nature is known, then there is no ego left. You cannot have both of them. Hence you cannot make any distinctions. You cannot distinguish them. They can't both be present together. Only one can be present. Right now whatsoever you are is ego. So don't be worried about distinguishing. If it was not ego, the question would not have arisen at all. Self-nature knows no questions. Self-nature is ecstasy, not a problem. The second question. Sir, please tell me, what is the difference between surrendering to a master and following a master? Edward Keffer There is a great difference. They are poles apart. Surrendering to a master is something of the heart. It is a love affair. It is not an intellectual conviction. It is not that you are convinced intellectually that what the master is saying is right. It is not philosophical. What the master is saying may be absurd. In fact, it is bound to be absurd. Because the master speaks from a totally different kind of vision, from such a peak where opposites meet, where the ultimate synthesis has happened, where life and death are one, where man and woman are one, where negative and positive are one. Hence, whatsoever he says is bound to be paradoxical. Surrendering to a master means you have felt the grace of the master. It is not a question of his knowledgeability. He may not be knowledgeable at all. Jesus was not knowledgeable. Muhammad was not even able to read or write. He was not even able to sign his own name. But thousands fell in deep love with the man. He had no logical acumen. If you go in Quran, you will not find great philosophy. Simple statements which can be refuted very easily. But the man must have had something totally different. So many people gravitated towards him. Now you cannot see gravitation. It is an energy. It is a force, invisible. It is a communion, heart to heart. The master's presence overwhelms you. Then the surrender happens. It is not something that you do. You cannot do surrender. Remember, a surrender done is not a surrender at all. Because you can withdraw. Any day you can say, I take my surrender back. A surrender is something that happens. Sometimes it happens even in spite of you. You never wanted it to happen. You resisted it. People resist to the very end. When it becomes impossible to resist, only then they surrender. Because surrender goes against the ego. It shatters your ego. The very idea of surrendering to someone is against our whole upbringing, our whole education, our whole psychology. We are brought up with the idea to have strong egos. Surrender means you are dropping your whole upbringing. You are pushing aside all your knowledge. You are bypassing your mind. You are allowing the heart to say yes, a total yes. It is an happening, not a doing. It is just like falling in love. What is the difference between falling in love and a marriage? An arranged marriage. Exactly that is the difference between surrendering to a master and following a master. Surrendering to a master is falling in love. But the force is irresistible. You are behaving like a madman. The master is mad. Now you are becoming mad. The master is like a flame, and you are moving towards the flame like a moth to your own death. Following a master is a safe phenomenon, like arranged marriage. It is moving on safe grounds. You think about everything, about the family of the woman or the man, about their economic status, about their social prestige, about everything except love. It is a calculated phenomenon. There is no risk in it. And not to take any chances, you go to the astrologer so that he can predict even the future. That how things will be going in the future. Will I be sailing safe? You make everything safe before you take the plunge. It is not a jump. It is a calculated step. That's what following a master is. It is intellectual. It is of the mind. It is of the head. You are trying to understand intellectually, logically, what he is saying. Does it appeal to you? And who are you? And what do you know? And how you are going to judge whether he is right or wrong, according to your prejudices, according to your conditionings. A Christian coming across Jesus may be impressed, but not a Jew. Because their conditionings differ. I have heard about two hippies. They were hungry and they had no money, and they were just passing on a Sunday morning by the side of a church. An idea occurs. Both had long hairs, beards, tattered clothes. They exactly looked like Jesus and his followers would have looked. One said to the others, We should find out a cross. We should go to the cemetery and take one cross from some grave. You carry the cross, you look more like Jesus. And I will go ahead of you, proclaiming that the Lord has come. Let us see. Maybe something is possible. So they entered the church. It was a Protestant church. The first entered and shouted loudly, "Awake! Behold, the Lord has come back. He has fulfilled His promise." So everybody looked, and then entered the second hippie with the cross. Few women fainted. Few old people fell into his feet, and people started giving money. When they went out, they had collected $50. They were very happy. The week went beautifully. Marijuana and all. They enjoyed it as spiritually as possible. Next week they entered a Catholic church. Even more. Things became possible. Catholics went crazy. They could not believe their eyes. People were crying and weeping and trembling and calling Lord. They collected $150. That week, they were really high. Third week, just for fun, they thought, why not try the synagogue? So they went into the synagogue. They proclaimed, "Behold, the Lord has come back as He has promised." And the old rabbi fixed his glasses, looked, asked his assistant, "You go and bring the hammer and the nails. It seems that fool has come back." You behave according to your conditioning. If a Mahavira appears suddenly on the MG road, only Jainas, and that too only Digambar Jainas, will recognize him. The Swetambar Jainas, another sect of the Jainas, will not recognize, because they don't believe that he lived naked. He lived in white clothes. Of course, those clothes were invisible. So they will ask, where are the invisible clothes? And Hindus and Mohammedans and Christians will simply rush to the police station that a naked man is standing on the MG road. Seems to be a Rajneesh freak. How you are going to judge according to your prejudices? When you become convinced that this man is saying the right thing, that simply means he is saying the thing that you think is right. But if you know already what is right, there is no need to bother about this man. Following is useless. It is unnecessary. You are simply collecting support for your own beliefs. It is not going to help. It is not going to change you. Only surrender transforms. Anything that happens through the heart can bring a radical revolution into your being. Head is important. Avoid the head. Sir, avoid the head. Listen to the heart and follow the heart, then surrender happens on its own accord. The third question. Bhagwan, what is misunderstanding? Sajananda, misunderstanding happens only to knowledgeable people. It never happens to the innocent. It never happens to those who know that they know nothing. To them only understanding happens. But to those who think they know already, their very knowledge is a disturbance, a distraction. It is knowledge that creates misunderstanding. If you are already carrying something in your mind and then you listen to me, only two are the possibilities. Either you find me agreeing with you, or you find me disagreeing with you. If you find me agreeing with you, you must have misunderstood. Because I cannot agree with you. It is impossible. I can agree with you only if you are also awakened. If you are also in the same space, only then. So you must have distorted the words, dropped few words, added few words, giving them new meanings, your meanings, coloring them according to your, dyeing them according to your philosophy, way of life, or whatsoever you call it. It is a kind of adjustment. And then you can be very happy that I agree with you. I cannot agree with you. It is impossible. Agreement is possible only if we both exist in the same space, otherwise not. In your confusion, in my clarity, there is no possibility of agreement. So that is the first kind of misunderstanding, which is far more dangerous than the second kind of misunderstanding. The second kind of misunderstanding is, I say one thing, you immediately jump against it because you have come with a negative approach. The first misunderstanding comes from the one who has come with a positive approach. Ordinarily, people think that if you come with a positive approach, you cannot misunderstand. Positive approach is very much appreciated around the world. Of course, your priests, your leaders praise your positive approach because you are agreeing with them. I cannot praise it because your agreement means nothing to me. Your negative approach means disagreement. But both are misunderstandings. If you have come already with a negative mind that you are against me, that this man is wrong, you must have gathered it from public opinion, from newspapers, from magazines. And if you have come already with a negative attitude, whatsoever I say, you will find something wrong in it. You are bent upon to find something wrong in it. That is another kind of misunderstanding. To me, both are misunderstandings. And the first is more dangerous, because the second misunderstanding is not going to do any harm. You will go empty-handed, that's all. You have not lost anything. But the first misunderstanding can be dangerous. You will go with the idea that I agree with you. You will become more egoistic, that your ideas are right. And that is more dangerous. If you think my ideas are wrong, there is no problem. You remain the same. But if you think that your ideas are right because they are in agreement with me and I am in agreement with you, then you are going with a more strengthened ego. The positive approach is far more dangerous than the negative. The real seeker comes with neither the positive mind nor the negative mind. He comes only with an open mind. He comes silently. He has no a priori idea, this way or that way. He simply listens. He does not interfere in it. He does not go on continuously judging. He remains in a kind of let go. Silent, open, vulnerable. It is not a question of agreeing, neither of disagreeing. You are simply listening. What this man has to say, you are simply listening. And you are not continuously commenting inside yourself that yes, this is right, that is wrong, this agrees with the Gita and this does not agree with Gita. If it does not agree with Gita, how this man can be right? Gita is bound to be right. And what do you know about Gita? All that you know about Gita is your idea of Gita. You can't understand Krishna. To understand Krishna, you have to be a Krishna. To understand Buddha, you have to be a Buddha. There is no other way. And when you are a Buddha, why you should bother to understand Buddha? When you are a Krishna, what is the need to understand Krishna? You yourself know. The real seeker listens with an empty mind, utterly empty. He listens totally. with no evaluation, no judgment, then there is no possibility of misunderstanding. And the miracle of right listening is that if you listen silently, whatsoever is true, it strikes immediately deep down somewhere in your heart, a chord, a rhythm. Deep down somewhere in your heart, a synchronicity happens. That is the miracle of truth. If the mind is silent, and if truth is being told, your heart immediately starts beating with it. It starts dancing with it. And that is true agreement. Not the agreement of the head, not the agreement of the ego, but something existential, something total. Then you have understood. And if something is not true, your heart remains cold. So there is no need to bother whether it is right or wrong. If it is right, it touches something so deep in you that you are not even aware that such a depth exists in you. And if it is not right, nothing moves in you. So your whole being becomes decisive, not just your head, which is just a fragment. And never allow the fragment to decide for the whole. Let the whole decide. The fantastic fisherman was telling Epal about his great dream. I had dreamed I was out on a lake alone in a boat with Elizabeth Taylor. His pal said, "Wow, how did you make out?" He said, "Great, I caught a 10-pound flounder." You know fishermen, you know people who are mad in catching fishes. Who cares about Elizabeth Taylor? That is besides the point. He catches a 10-pound flounder. He was really a golf nut. He was just about to tee off on the first hole when a beautiful girl came running up to him in a gorgeous bridal outfit. The golfer waved her away and said, "Sylvia, I told you, only if it rains." Two drunks were driving over a bridge and one said, "When you come to the end of the bridge, turn left." The other slobbered, "What are you telling me for? You are driving." In your state of sleep, in your state of drunkenness, what agreement, what disagreement, what understanding, what misunderstanding? It is all the same. Here, listening to me, become more and more silent and alert. Forget all about agreeing and disagreeing. I am not interested in converting you. I am not a missionary. I am not interested in creating a following. Not at all. I am certainly interested in sharing my joy with you. Certainly interested in sharing my truth with you. But that is a totally different matter. Dev and Mabel were just married, and on their way home to the farm, their old horse was getting slower and slower, and despite Dev's efforts, just before dusk the nag fell and died. There was nothing to do but put up camp for the night under a nearby tree. The newly weds snuggled under the blanket, and Dev turned to Mabel saying, "Well, what about it, love?" "What about what, dear?" Mabel replied. "Ah, never mind," said Dev. Sadly, after Dev said, "Well, what about it?" Mabel replied, "What about what, dear?" Dev asked, "Did not your mum ever tell you about what marriage is for?" Mabel answered, "I don't know what you mean, dear." Dev said, "Well, you are a woman and I am a man, and you see, well, a man has this and it gives life." "Well, for God's sake, Dev," said Mabel, "go and stick it in the horse and let us get going." The fourth question. Bhagwan, in your prophetic vision, what do you think will be the future of science? Raju Bharti, I have no prophetic vision. I am not a prophet. I am not that old fashioned at all. Do you think I am coming out of the Old Testament? I am a 20th century man. And is still fully alive. And I don't care a bit about the future. Neither I care about the past. My whole concern is the present, because only the present exists. The past is no more, the future is not yet. Both are non-existential. Those prophets must have been mad who were concerned about the future. They were always talking about the future. There are only two types of mad people in the world: few who are always talking about the past, and few who are always talking about the future. The people who are talking about the past are the historians, archaeologists, etc. And the people who are talking about the future are the prophets, visionaries, poets. I am neither. My whole concern is this moment. Now. Here. So drop that idea, Raju. Raju is a scientist. And naturally interested in the future of science. I am not a prophet, but one thing I can say, and it has nothing to do with the future really, it is right now happening. Because people are blind, they cannot see it. I can see it. It has already become a reality. The greatest thing that is happening, which will be understood only later on, is the meeting of science and religion. Is the meeting of East and West. Is the meeting of materialism and spiritualism. Is the meeting of the outer and the inner. Is the meeting of the extrovert and the introvert. But that is right now happening. It will grow in the future. But my concern is the present. And I am tremendously happy that something of great importance is on the way. The seed has sprouted. You are so much concerned with the past or with the future that you can't see that is small sprout that is growing right now. Here, under your eyes, the meeting of the opposites. The opposites are turning into complementaries. Science alone is only half and cannot be a fulfillment for man. It can give you a better body. It can give you better health, longer life. It can give you more comforts, more luxury. And I am not against of any of these. I am not an ascetic. I am not that stupid at all. But it can only give you things of the outer world, which are beautiful in themselves. I would like everyone to live in more comfort, in more luxury, in better health, better nourished, better fed, better educated. But that's not all. That is only the circumference of life, not the center. Religion provides the center. It gives you a soul. Without it, science is a corpse. Beautiful corpse, maybe. You can paint the corpse. You can wash the corpse and put on beautiful garments. But a corpse is a corpse. And remember, the same is the case with religion. Religion alone is not enough at all. Religion alone makes you a ghost, maybe a holy ghost, but it makes you a ghost. You can see this happening in India. The whole country has become holy ghost. The body has disappeared. The physical health has disappeared. The material wealth has disappeared. And when there is no body to support a soul, you are talking simply nonsense. You can go on talking about the Brahma, the ultimate reality, but on a hungry stomach, it does not suit. It may be just an escape from the reality. Religion becomes an escape from reality if religion itself is not realistic. If religion is not materialistic enough, it becomes an escape. It becomes a dream world, a Disneyland. That's what has happened in the East. We talked too much of the spirit and forgot all about the reality that surrounds us. We became introverts, too much concerned about ourselves. We forgot all about the beauties of the trees and the mountains and the sun and the moon and the stars. Humanity in the East became ugly. It has a center, but no circumference. Everything has shrunk to the center. The West has a circumference, but no center. People have everything, but something essential is missing. Science and religion are becoming one. They are already becoming one. I am not saying they will become one. They are already becoming one. All the greatest scientists, Eddington, Planck, Einstein, people of the highest caliber in the world of science, became aware that science alone is not enough. Something far more mysterious is there, which cannot be grasped only through scientific methodology and means, which needs a different approach, which needs more meditative awareness. Eddington says in his autobiography that when I started my career as a scientist, I used to think that the world consists of things. But as I am growing old, I am becoming more and more aware that the world does not consist of things, but it consists of thoughts. The reality is far more closer to thoughts than to things. The reality is far more mysterious than you can weigh, measure, than you can experiment with. The reality is not only the objective, but also the subjective. The reality is not only of the content, but also of consciousness. And the greatest religious people, like Jai Krishnamurti, are aware that religion cannot exist as it has existed up to now anymore. Something of a radical change is needed. My own approach is that we have to create Zorba the Buddha. Today, just by coincidence, is Buddha's birthday.
also his enlightenment day and also his day of death. He was born on this day. He became enlightened on this day. He died on this day. 2 days full moon belongs to him. It is a strange coincidence that this long series of Buddha lectures, 120 lectures in all, when I had started, I had no idea that it will end today. Just the other night, Lakshmi told me that tomorrow is Buddha Purnima, Buddha's full moon. Let this day also be the birth of a new Buddha. The new Buddha will be a synthesis of Zorba the Greek and Gautam the Buddha. He cannot be just Zorba. And he cannot be just the Buddha. And that's my whole effort, Raju, here, to create a bridge between Zorba and Buddha. To create a bridge, a golden bridge, or a rainbow bridge between the earth, this source, and the farther source, the beyond. It is happening here. You can't see it happening anywhere else. We have all kinds of scientists here. Now Raju himself has become a sannyasi. He has great scientific intelligence. Young, but of tremendous intelligence. He is one of those scientists who have put the first man on the moon. He belongs to that project. There are so many other scientists here. There are poets and musicians, painters, all kinds of people. And they have all joined together into one great effort, meditation. There is only one meeting point here, and that is meditation. On only one point they meet, otherwise they have all their own individualities. Out of this meeting, tremendous explosion is possible. It is already happening. Those who have eyes can see it happening. This may be the only place on the earth where all the countries are represented. I am happy to say that we were missing Russians, now they are also here. All the races are meeting here. All the religions are meeting here. This is a miniature universe, a small world. And we are all meeting here as human beings. Nobody is a Christian, Hindu or Mohammedan. Nobody knows who is a scientist, who is a musician, who is a painter, who is a famous actor. Nobody even tells. Just the other day, I came across a news. One of our sannyasins has won a great world famous prize. She has been here for months, but she never told that she is a great actress. And now she is world famous. She is thought to be now one of the most serious contenders for the highest award. But she never told anything to anybody. There are musicians of great caliber, poets, authors, painters, sculptors, magicians, all kinds of people are here. And they have all met into a deep merging. Their only meeting point is meditation and their love for their masters. A totally new science is bound to arrive. It will be science and religion both. Only then it can be total. It will be science of the inner and the outer both. In fact, days of religion are over. Only science will do. One word will do. Science is a beautiful word. It means knowing, wisdom. Science should be divided in two categories. The objective science, chemistry, physics, mathematics, etc., and the subjective science. Then there is no need to divide religion and science, and the meeting of religion and science into one whole will create for the first time a whole man on the earth. Otherwise, up to now, humanity has been schizophrenic, split, insane, divided. I am all for the whole man, because to me the whole man is the holy man. The fifth question, Bhagwan, what is the difference between being mad and being enlightened? Deva sadhyo, not much. The only difference is the enlightened person knows that he is mad, and the madman does not know that he is mad. The sixth question, Bhagwan, if Italians are women, British are ladies, and Germans are females, what about South American witches? Can you make some comment about them? Devasamya, they are Amazons. The seventh question. Bhagwan, I am leaving tomorrow for France. Please tell me a joke to make the Frenchies laugh. Toshin, an agitated Frenchman, came into Paris bistro and told the waiter to bring him a triple shot of cognac. He
he downed the huge drink in one gulp and asked for another. The waiter brought it and asked, "What is the matter, Moshe? Your wife catch you making love to the maid?" "No," he sighed. "The maid caught me in bed with my wife." The eighth question, Bhagwan, why does the Buddha always say, "Be a light unto yourself"? Paritoso, simple. Buddha says, "Be a light unto yourself," because you cannot trust Indian electricity. In fact, you cannot trust anything made in India. What is the difference between an American computer and an Indian one? The American computer has a memory, the Indian one has a vague remembrance. How many pollocks does it take to put in a light bulb? 4. 1 to hold the bulb and 3 to spin him around. How many Jews does it take to put in a light bulb? 3. 1 to put it in and 2 to supervise. How many Californians does it take to put in a light bulb? 4. 1 to put it in and 3 to share the experience. How many Italians does it take to put a light bulb in? About 16. 1 to give the orders, 1 to handle the money, 1 to get the bulb, 1 to tell the rickshaw driver where to go, 1 to clean up the broken glass, 1 to translate, 3 to carry the ladder, 1 to check the switch, 1 to shoo away the beggars, 4 to entertain you while you wait, 2 or 3 minutes, 2 or 3 minutes, 2 or 3 minutes, etc., etc. And how many Indians it takes to change a light bulb? 200. 1 to hold the bulb and 199 to turn the house around. And the last question, Bhagwan, in a previous life, you must have been an Italian. Could you say something about that experience? Satyen, I am not a Californian, so I cannot share the experience with you. But I will tell you few jokes. I find it hard to believe that you murdered that crippled old man for 50 cents. The outraged judge told the Italian mugger. The Italian shrugged. 50 cents here, 50 cents there, it adds up.
Martinelli always takes his super ugly wife along with him when he goes away on business. He explains it is easier to take her along than to kiss her goodbye. Maria was complaining to her neighbor, Donna Arminda, "These pains drive me crazy. Every night it is the same thing. If I turn right, the pain attacks the liver. If I turn left, it attacks my heart. It is really hell. But why don't you sleep on your belly?" asked the neighbor. "On my belly? If I sleep on my belly, Roberto attacks me." An Italian was walking down the street with a pig under his arm. "How much did that cost you?" asked a passerby. 50 cents, replied the pig. "I see you are no gentleman," hissed the woman on the street corner at the Italian, who laughed as the wind swept her skirt over her head. "No," he replied, "and I see you are not a one either." A long-suffering Italian husband was burying his wife. It chanced that in passing through the gate, the coffin had been thrust hard against one of the posts. Almost immediately, to the amazement of the mourners, a muffled scream was heard. The lid was hastily unscrewed, and lo, the woman was not dead at all. She was taken home and lived for 3 years. Then she died again. At the funeral, as the coffin was being lowered from the hearse, the husband addressed the bearers very solemnly, "Boys, mind that post." Enough for today.